Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks. This episode of Sleepy is proudly sponsored by ButcherBox. If you've listened to Sleepy for a while, you know that I love good food, eating well, and treating my body right so that I can take on my days. Well, ButcherBox helps you do exactly that. They deliver super high quality, 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork, and wild-caught seafood right to your door. It's humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. They have a huge variety to choose from. They are excellent deals. They've got recipes and guides and tips included, and there's free shipping, always. Eating well is a huge factor in getting a good night's sleep, as is sometimes saving the trip to the grocery store and taking some stress out of your daily schedule. I have been loving these deliveries for those reasons. Been cooking up their steak tips with eggs in the morning, with butter and scallions and soy sauce, and I also made a delicious brine chicken roast with lemon parsley gravy. So good. The prices for this kind of quality and convenience is really impressive. ButcherBox has made me very happy. So sign up at butcherbox.com/sleepy and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/sleepy and use code SLEEPY to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order. butcherbox.com/sleepy. Eat well, sleep well.
Welcome to the I Can't Sleep podcast with Benjamin Boster. If you're tired of sleepless nights, you'll love the I Can't Sleep podcast. I help quiet your mind by reading random articles from across the web to bore you to sleep with my soothing voice. Each episode provides enough interesting content to hold your attention, and then your mind lets you drift off. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's I Can't Sleep with Benjamin Boster.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, and you're listening to Sleepy. Podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep, and a proud member of the Airwave Podcast Network. I have got a wonderful, snoozy bedtime story for you tonight. But before we get to tonight's reading, I just want to thank all of our patrons on Patreon.com. Steve Altfilish, Shelby Hickey, and Mary Casa. Thank you all so, so much. It really means a lot. And for anyone who doesn't know, These names that I just read are brand new supporters of this podcast on patreon.com, which is a wonderful site where you can go and support creators of the work that you like. So if you like the Sleepy Podcast and maybe it's helped you get a better night's rest, wake up more refreshed the next day, then consider going to patreon.com/sleepyradio and donating even $1 a month. It goes a really long way. At $5 a month, you get access to over 50 extra poetry readings that are not on the regular podcast feed. But no matter how much you donate, I will read your name in the opening credits of the next show after you do. So, if you would like to be a part of making this show, just go to patreon.com/sleepyradio and come say hi. Thank you. And as always, the music you're hearing is by my good friend James Lepkowski, and the cover of For Sleepy is by Gracie Kanan. Well, tonight, I have a kind of romance novel for you. It is The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. This turned out to be a pretty funny, perfect story to fall asleep to, because Wilkie Collins begins to write this story about the Moonstone in chapter one and realizes that he's gotten kind of distracted and written about other stuff. So in chapter two, he kind of tries to start the story of the Moonstone again, but once again gets sidetracked. And by the end of chapter two, he's kind of ready to start the story for a third time. So it's this story that kind of begins and doesn't necessarily go anywhere for the first two chapters, which for us going to sleep tonight is pretty perfect. So tonight we'll be sort of telling the story of the Moonstone. You'll hear the first two chapters as he attempts to start to tell that story, and then you'll hear them again, so you can fall deep asleep and stay deep asleep to this story that kind of never starts. I really hope you sleep soundly to this snoozy reading of The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. And now is the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. Chapter 1. In the first part of Robinson Crusoe, at page 129, you will find it thus written: "Now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Only yesterday I opened my Robinson Crusoe at that place. Only this morning, May 21st, 1850, came my lady's nephew, Mr. Franklin Blake, and held a short conversation with me, as follows: 'Betteridge,' says Mr. Franklin, 'I have been to the lawyers about some family matters, and, among other things, we have been talking of the loss of the Indian diamond in my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years since. Mr. Brah thinks as I think, that the whole story are, in the interest of truth, to be placed on record in writing, and the sooner the better. Not perceiving his drift yet, and thinking it always desirable for the sake of peace and quietness to be on the lawyer's side, I said I thought so too. Mr. Franklin went on. In this matter of the diamond, he said, the characters of innocent people have suffered under suspicion already, as you know. The memories of innocent people may suffer hereafter for want of a record of the facts to which those who come after us can appeal. There can be no doubt that this strange family story of ours ought to be told. And I think, Betteredge, Mr. Brough and I together have hit on the right way of telling it. Very satisfactory to both of them, no doubt, but I failed to see what I myself had to do with it so far. We have certain events to relate, Mr. Franklin proceeded, and we have certain persons concerned in those events who are capable of relating them. Starting from these plain facts, the idea is that we should all write the story of the Moonstone in turn, as far as our own personal experience extends, and no farther. We must begin by showing how the diamond first fell into the hands of my uncle Herncastle, when he was serving in India 50 years since. This prefatory narrative I have already got by me in the form of an old family paper, which relates the necessary particulars on the authority of an eyewitness. The next thing to do is to tell how the diamond found its way into my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years ago, and how it came to be lost in little more than 12 hours afterwards. Nobody knows as much as you do, Betteredge, about what went on in the house at the time. So you must take the pen in hand and start the story. In those terms, I was informed of what my personal concern was with the matter of the diamond. If you are curious to know what course I took under the circumstances, I beg to inform you that I did what you would probably have done in my place. I modestly declared myself to be quite unequal to the task imposed upon me, and I privately felt, all the time, that I was quite clever enough to perform it, if I only gave my own abilities a fair chance. Mr. Franklin, I imagine, must have seen my private sentiments in my face. He declined to believe in my modesty, and he insisted on giving my abilities a fair chance. 2 hours have passed since Mr. Franklin left me. As soon as his back was turned, I went to my writing desk to start the story. There I sat helpless, in spite of my abilities, ever since, seeing what Robinson Crusoe saw, as quoted above, namely, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Please to remember, I opened the book by accident, at that bit, only the day before I rashly undertook the business now in hand. And, allow me to ask, if that isn't prophecy, what is? I am not superstitious. I have read a heap of books in my time. I am a scholar in my own way. Though turned 70, I possess an active memory and legs to correspond. You are not to make it, if you please, as the saying of an ignorant man,
when I expressed my opinion that such a book as Robinson Crusoe never was written and never will be written again. I have tried that book for years, generally in combination with a pipe of tobacco, and I have found it my friend in need in all necessities of this mortal life. When my spirits are bad, Robinson Crusoe. When I want advice, Robinson Crusoe. In past times when my wife plagued me, in present times when I have had a drop too much, Robinson Crusoe. I have worn out 6 stout Robinson Crusoes with hard work in my service. On my lady's last birthday, she gave me a 7th. I took a drop too much on the strength of it, and Robinson Crusoe put me right again. Price 4 shillings and 6 pence, bound in blue, with a picture into the bargain. Still, this don't much look like starting the story of the diamond, does it? I seem to be wandering off in search of Lord knows what, Lord knows where. We will take a new sheet of paper, if you please, and begin over again. With my best respects to you. Chapter 2. I spoke of my lady a line or two back. Now the diamond could never have been in our house, where it was lost, if it had not been made a present of to my lady's daughter. And my lady's daughter would never have been in existence to have the present, if it had not been for my lady, who, with pain and travail, produced her into the world. Consequently, if we begin with my lady, we are pretty sure of beginning far enough back. And that, let me tell you, when you've got such a job as mine at hand, is a real comfort at starting. If you know anything of the fashionable world, you have heard tell of the 3 beautiful Miss Herncastles, Miss Adelaide, Miss Caroline, and Miss Julia, this last being the youngest and the best of the 3 sisters, in my opinion. And I had opportunities of judging, as you shall presently see. I went to the service of the old lord, their father. Thank God we have got nothing to do with him in this business of the diamond. He had the longest tongue and the shortest temper of any man, high or low, I ever met with. I say, I went into the service of the old lord as a page boy in waiting on the 3 honorable young ladies at the age of 15 years. There I lived till Miss Julia married the late Sir John Verinder, an excellent man who only wanted somebody to manage him. And between ourselves, he found somebody to do it. And what is more, he throve on it, and grew fat on it, and lived happy and died easy on it, dating from the day when my lady took him to church to be married, to the day when she relieved him of his last breath and closed his eyes forever. I have omitted to state that I went with the bride to the bride's husband's house and lands down here. Sir John, she says, I can't do without Gabriel Betteredge. My lady, says Sir John, I can't do without him either. That was his way with her, and that was how I went into his service. It was all one to me where I went, so long as my mistress and I were together. Seeing that my lady took an interest in the out-of-door work and the farms and such like, I took an interest to them, too. With all the more reason that I was a small farmer, seventh son myself. My lady got me put under the bailiff, and I did my best and gave satisfaction and got promotion accordingly. Some years later, on the Monday as it might be, my lady says, "Sir John, your bailiff is a stupid old man. Pension him liberally, and let Gabriel Betteridge have his place." On the Tuesday, as it might be, Sir John says, "My lady, the bailiff is pensioned liberally, and Gabriel Betteridge has got his place." You hear more than enough of married people living together miserably. Here is an example of the contrary. Let it be a warning to some of you, and an encouragement to others. In the meantime, I will go on with my story. Well, there I was in clover, you will say, placed in a position of trust and honor, with a little cottage of my own to live in, with my rounds on the estate to occupy me in the morning, and my accounts in the afternoon, and my pipe, and my Robinson Crusoe in the evening. What more could I possibly want to make me happy? Remember what Adam wanted when he was alone in the Garden of Eden. And if you don't blame it on Adam, don't blame it on me. The woman I fixed my eye on was the woman who kept house for me in my cottage. Her name was Selina Gobi. I agree with the late William Cobbett about picking a wife. See that she chews her food well and sets her foot down firmly on the ground when she walks, and you're all right. Selina Gobi was all right in both these respects, which was one reason for marrying her. I had another reason, likewise, entirely of my own discovery. Selina, being a single woman, made me pay so much for a week for her board and services. Selina, being my wife, couldn't charge for her board and would have to give me her services for nothing. That was the point of view I looked at it from. Economy, with a dash of love. I put it to my mistress as in duty bound, just as I had put it to myself. "I have been turning Selina Gobi over in my mind," I said, "and I think, my lady, it will be cheaper to marry her than to keep her." My lady burst out laughing and said she didn't know which to be most shocked at, my language or my principles. Some joke tickled her, I suppose, of the sort that you can't take unless you are a person of quality. Understanding nothing myself, but that I was free to put it next to Selina, I went and put it accordingly. And what did Selina say? "Lord, how little you must know of women if you ask that." "Of course," she said. "Yes." As my time drew nearer, and there got to be talk of my having a new coat for the ceremony, my mind began to misgive me. I have compared notes with other men as to what they felt while they were in my interesting situation, and they have all acknowledged that, about a week before it happened, they privately wished themselves out of it. I went a trifle farther than that myself. I actually rose up, as it were, and tried to get out of it. Not for nothing. I was, too, just a man to expect she would let me off for nothing. Compensation to the woman when the man gets out of it is one of the laws of England. in obedience to the laws, and after turning it over carefully in my mind, I offered Selena Gobi a feather bed and 50 shillings to be off the bargain. You will hardly believe it, but it is nevertheless true. She was fool enough to refuse. After that, it was all over with me, of course. I got the new coat as cheap as I could, and I went through all the rest of it as cheap as I could. We were not a happy couple, and not a miserable couple. We were 6 of 1.5 dozen of the other. How it was, I don't understand, but we always seemed to be getting, with the best of motives, in one another's way. When I wanted to go upstairs, there was my wife coming down. Or when my wife wanted to go down, there was I coming up. That is married life, according to my experience of it. After 5 years of misunderstandings on the stairs, it pleased an all-wise providence to relieve us of each other by taking my wife. I was left with my little girl, Penelope, and with no other child. Shortly afterwards, Sir John died, and my lady was left with her little girl, Miss Rachel, and no other child. I have written to very poor purpose of my lady, if you require to be told that my little Penelope was taken care of under my good mistress's own eye, and was sent to school and taught, and made a sharp girl, and promoted, when old enough, to be Miss Rachel's own maid. As for me, I went on with my business as bailiff, year after year, up to Christmas 1847, when there came a change in my life. On that day, my lady invited herself to a cup of tea, alone with me in my cottage. She remarked that, reckoning from the year when I started as a page boy in the time of the old lord, I had been more than 50 years in her service. And she put into my hands a beautiful waistcoat of wool that she had worked herself to keep me warm in the bitter winter weather. I received this magnificent present quite at a loss to find words to thank my mistress with for the honor that she had done me. To my great astonishment, it turned out, however, that the waistcoat was not an honor, but a bribe. My lady had discovered that I was getting old before I discovered it myself, and she had come to my cottage to wheedle me, if I may use such an expression, into giving up my hard out-of-door work as bailiff and taking my ease for the rest of my days as steward in the house. I made as good a fight of it against the indignity of taking my ease as I could. But my mistress knew the weak side of me. She put it as a favor to herself. The dispute between us ended after that, in my wiping my eyes like an old fool with my new woolen waistcoat and saying I would think about it. The perturbation in my mind in regard to thinking about it, being truly dreadful after my lady had gone away, I applied the remedy which I have never yet found to fail me in cases of doubt and emergency. I smoked a pipe and took a turn at Robinson Crusoe. Before I had occupied myself with that extraordinary book 5 minutes, I came on a comforting bit, page 158, as follows. Today we love what tomorrow we hate. I saw my way clear directly. Today, I was all for continuing to be farm bailiff. Tomorrow, on the authority of Robinson Crusoe, I should be all the other way. Take myself tomorrow, while in tomorrow's humor, and the thing was done. My mind being relieved in this manner, I went to sleep that night in the character of Lady Verinder's farm bailiff, and I woke up the next morning in the character of Lady Verinder's house steward, all quite comfortable, and all through Robinson Crusoe. My daughter Penelope has just looked over my shoulder to see what I have done so far. She remarks that it is beautifully written, and every word of it true. But she points out one objection. She says what I have done so far isn't in the least what I was wanted to do. I am asked to tell the story of the diamond, and instead of that, I have been telling the story of my own self. Curious and quite beyond me to account for. I wonder whether the gentlemen who make a business and a living out of writing books ever find their own selves getting in the way of their subjects like me. If they do, I can feel for them. In the meantime, here is another false start, and more waste of good writing paper. What's to be done now? Nothing that I know of, except for you to keep your temper, and for me to begin it all over again, for the third time. Chapter 1. In the first part of Robinson Crusoe, at page 129, you will find it thus written. Now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Only yesterday I opened my Robinson Crusoe at that place. Only this morning, May 21st, 1850, came my lady's nephew, Mr. Franklin Blake, and held a short conversation with me, as follows. Betteridge, says Mr. Franklin, I have been to the lawyers about some family matters, and, among other things, we have been talking of the loss of the Indian diamond in my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years since. Mr. Brough thinks, as I think, that the whole story ought, in the interest of truth, to be placed on record in writing, and the sooner the better. Not perceiving his drift yet, and thinking it always desirable for the sake of peace and quietness to be on the lawyer's side, I said I thought so too. Mr. Franklin went on. In this matter of the diamond, he said, the characters of innocent people have suffered under suspicion already, as you know. The memories of innocent people may suffer hereafter for want of a record of the facts to which those who come after us can appeal. There can be no doubt that this strange family story of ours ought to be told. And I think, Betteridge, Mr. Brough and I together have hit on the right way of telling it. Very satisfactory to both of them, no doubt, but I failed to see what I myself had to do with it so far. We have certain events to relate, Mr. Franklin proceeded, and we have certain persons concerned in those events who are capable of relating them. Starting from these plain facts, The idea is that we should all write the story of the Moonstone in turn, as far as our own personal experience extends, and no farther. We must begin by showing how the diamond first fell into the hands of my uncle, Herncastle, when he was serving in India 50 years since. This prefatory narrative I have already got by me in the form of an old family paper, which relates the necessary particulars on the authority of an eyewitness. The next thing to do is to tell how the diamond found its way into my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years ago, and how it came to be lost in little more than 12 hours afterwards. Nobody knows as much as you do, Betteredge, about what went on in the house at the time. So you must take the pen in hand and start the story. In those terms, I was informed of what my personal concern was with the matter of the diamond. If you are curious to know what course I took under the circumstances, I beg to inform you that I did what you would probably have done in my place. I modestly declared myself to be quite unequal to the task imposed upon me, and I privately felt, all the time, that I was quite clever enough to perform it, if I only gave my own abilities a fair chance. Mr. Franklin, I imagine, must have seen my private sentiments in my face. He declined to believe in my modesty, and he insisted on giving my abilities a fair chance. 2 hours have passed since Mr. Franklin left me. As soon as his back was turned, I went to my writing desk to start the story. There I sat helpless, in spite of my abilities, ever since, seeing what Robinson Crusoe saw, as quoted above, namely, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Please to remember, I opened the book by accident, at that bit, only the day before I rashly undertook the business now in hand. And, allow me to ask, if that isn't prophecy, what is? I am not superstitious. I have read a heap of books in my time. I am a scholar in my own way. Though turned 70, I possess an active memory and legs to correspond. You are not to make it, if you please, as the saying of an ignorant man, when I express my opinion that such a book as Robinson Crusoe never was written and never will be written again. I have tried that book for years, generally in combination with a pipe of tobacco, and I have found it my friend in need in all necessities of this mortal life. When my spirits are bad, Robinson Crusoe. When I want advice, Robinson Crusoe. In past times when my wife plagued me, in present times when I have had a drop too much, Robinson Crusoe. I have worn out 6 stout Robinson Crusoes with hard work in my service. On my lady's last birthday, she gave me a 7th. I took a drop too much on the strength of it, and Robinson Crusoe put me right again. Price 4 shillings and 6 pence, bound in blue, with a picture, into the bargain. Still, this don't much look like starting the story of the diamond, does it? I seem to be wandering off in search of Lord knows what, Lord knows where. We will take a new sheet of paper, if you please, and begin over again, with my best respects to you. Chapter 2. I spoke of my lady a line or two back. Now the diamond could never have been in our house, where it was lost, if it had not been made a present of to my lady's daughter. And my lady's daughter would never have been in existence to have the present, if it had not been for my lady, who, with pain and travail, produced her into the world. Consequently, if we begin with my lady, we are pretty sure of beginning far enough back. And that, let me tell you, when you've got such a job as mine at hand, is a real comfort at starting. If you know anything of the fashionable world, you have heard tell of the three beautiful Miss Herncastles, Miss Adelaide, Miss Caroline, and Miss Julia, this last being the youngest and the best of the three sisters, in my opinion. And I had opportunities of judging, as you shall presently see. I went to the service of the old lord, their father. Thank God we have got nothing to do with him in this business of the diamond. He had the longest tongue and the shortest temper of any man, high or low, I ever met with. I say, I went into the service of the old lord as a page boy in waiting on the three honorable young ladies at the age of 15 years. There I lived till Miss Julia married the late Sir John Verinder, an excellent man, who only wanted somebody to manage him. And between ourselves, he found somebody to do it. And what is more, he throve on it, and grew fat on it, and lived happy and died easy on it, dating from the day when my lady took him to church to be married, to the day when she relieved him of his last breath and closed his eyes forever. I have omitted to state that I went with the bride to the bride's husband's house and lands down here. Sir John, she says, I can't do without Gabriel Betteredge. My lady, says Sir John, I can't do without him either. That was his way with her, and that was how I went into his service. It was all one to me where I went, so long as my mistress and I were together. Seeing that my lady took an interest in the out-of-door work, in the farms and such like, I took an interest to them too, with all the more reason that I was a small farmer, seventh son myself. My lady got me put under the bailiff, and I did my best, and gave satisfaction, and got promotion accordingly. Some years later, on the Monday as it might be, my lady says, Sir John, your bailiff is a stupid old man. Pension him liberally, and let Gabriel Betteredge have his place. On the Tuesday, as it might be, Sir John says, My lady, the bailiff is pensioned liberally, and Gabriel Betteredge has got his place. You hear more than enough of married people living together miserably. Here is an example of the contrary. Let it be a warning to some of you, and an encouragement to others. In the meantime, I will go on with my story. Well, there I was in clover, you will say, placed in a position of trust and honor, with a little cottage of my own to live in, with my rounds on the estate to occupy me in the morning, and my accounts in the afternoon, and my pipe, and my Robinson Crusoe in the evening. What more could I possibly want? to make me happy. Remember what Adam wanted when he was alone in the Garden of Eden. And if you don't blame it on Adam, don't blame it on me. The woman I fixed my eye on was the woman who kept house for me in my cottage. Her name was Selena Gobi. I agree with the late William Cobbett about picking a wife. See that she chews her food well and sets her foot down firmly on the ground when she walks, and you're all right. Selena Gobi was all right in both these respects, which was one reason for marrying her. I had another reason, likewise, entirely of my own discovery. Selena, being a single woman, made me pay so much for a week for her board and services. Selena, being my wife, couldn't charge for her board and would have to give me her services for nothing. That was the point of view I looked at it from. Economy, with a dash of love. I put it to my mistress as in duty bound, just as I had put it to myself. I have been turning Selena Gobi over in my mind, I said, and I think, my lady, it will be cheaper to marry her than to keep her. My lady burst out laughing and said she didn't know which to be most shocked at, my language or my principles. Some joke tickled her, I suppose, of the sort that you can't take unless you are a person of quality. Understanding nothing myself, but that I was free to put it next to Selena, I went and put it accordingly. And what did Selena say? Lord, how little you must know of women if you ask that. Of course, she said. Yes. As my time drew nearer, and there got to be talk of my having a new coat for the ceremony, my mind began to misgive me. I have compared notes with other men as to what they felt while they were in my interesting situation, and they have all acknowledged that, about a week before it happened, they privately wished themselves out of it. I went a trifle farther than that myself. I actually rose up, as it were, and tried to get out of it. Not for nothing. I was, too, just a man to expect she would let me off for nothing. Compensation to the woman when the man gets out of it is one of the laws of England. In obedience to the laws, and after turning it over carefully in my mind, I offered Selena Gobi a feather bed and 50 shillings to be off the bargain. You will hardly believe it, but it is nevertheless true. She was fool enough to refuse. After that, it was all over with me, of course. I got the new coat as cheap as I could, and I went through all the rest of it as cheap as I could. We were not a happy couple, and not a miserable couple. We were 6 of 1.5 dozen of the other. How it was, I don't understand, but we always seemed to be getting, with the best of motives, in one another's way. When I wanted to go upstairs, there was my wife coming down. Or when my wife wanted to go down, there was I coming up. That is married life, according to my experience of it. After 5 years of misunderstandings on the stairs, it pleased an all-wise providence to relieve us of each other by taking my wife. I was left with my little girl, Penelope, and with no other child. Shortly afterwards, Sir John died, and my lady was left with her little girl, Miss Rachel, and no other child. I have written to very poor purpose of my lady. If you require to be told that my little Penelope was taken care of under my good mistress's own eye, and was sent to school and taught, and made a sharp girl, and promoted when old enough to be Miss Rachel's own maid. As for me, I went on with my business as bailiff year after year up to Christmas 1847, when there came a change in my life. On that day, my lady invited herself to a cup of tea alone with me in my cottage. She remarked that, reckoning from the year when I started as a page boy in the time of the old lord, I had been more than 50 years in her service. And she put into my hands a beautiful waistcoat of wool that she had worked herself to keep me warm in the bitter winter weather. I received this magnificent present quite at a loss to find words to thank my mistress with for the honor that she had done me. To my great astonishment, it turned out, however, that the waistcoat was not an honor, but a bribe. My lady had discovered that I was getting old before I discovered it myself, and she had come to my cottage to wheedle me, if I may use such an expression, into giving up my hard out-of-door work as bailiff and taking my ease for the rest of my days as steward in the house. I made as good a fight of it against the indignity of taking my ease as I could. But my mistress knew the weak side of me. She put it as a favor to herself. The dispute between us ended after that in my wiping my eyes like an old fool with my new woolen waistcoat and saying I would think about it. The perturbation in my mind in regard to thinking about it, being truly dreadful after my lady had gone away, I applied the remedy which I have never yet found to fail me in cases of doubt and emergency. I smoked a pipe and took a turn at Robinson Crusoe. Before I had occupied myself with that extraordinary book 5 minutes, I came on a comforting bit, page 158, as follows. Today we love what tomorrow we hate. I saw my way clear directly. Today I was all for continuing to be farm bailiff. Tomorrow, on the authority of Robinson Crusoe, I should be all the other way. Take myself tomorrow while in tomorrow's humor, and the thing was done. My mind being relieved in this manner, I went to sleep that night in the character of Lady Barrander's farm bailiff. And I woke up the next morning in the character of Lady Verinder's house steward, all quite comfortable, and all through Robinson Crusoe. My daughter Penelope has just looked over my shoulder to see what I have done so far. She remarks that it is beautifully written, and every word of it true. But she points out one objection. She says what I have done so far isn't in the least what I was wanted to do. I am asked to tell the story of the diamond, and instead of that, I have been telling the story of my own self. Curious and quite beyond me to account for. I wonder whether the gentlemen who make a business and a living out of writing books ever find their own selves getting in the way of their subjects like me. If they do, I can feel for them. In the meantime, here is another false star, and more waste of good writing paper. What's to be done now? Nothing that I know of, except for you to keep your temper, and for me to begin it all over again, for the third time. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.